NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
The Flight Safety Detectives is bringing on a new sponsor, Piston Powered, a power-by-the-hour program for owners of piston-powered aircraft that can stabilize the long-term cost of owning your airplane. John will talk about them a little bit later in the show. In a future episode, we'll have Piston Power on to talk about in detail what they can do for you.
Well, hello, Todd.
Well, there's John.
All right, I guess it's you and me today. Greg is off in the wild blue someplace. And I understand you have a challenge for me. You have an interesting accident that's right up my alley.
That's correct. This is an accident that involves a unapproved part, but in a different kind of way than what you've dealt with for the most part in the past. But let me quit teasing it and get you straight to the event in question. This was an event on May 2nd, 2018, involving a Piper Cherokee at West Milford, New Jersey. This aircraft, with a single person on board, was taking off on a fairly short flight, about 23 nautical miles. And shortly after takeoff, according to the investigation, there was an engine compartment fire and the aircraft crashed about 1,000 feet north of 1,000 feet away from the departure end of the runway. And specifically, this was a fuel inlet line from the fuel pump to the fuel servo was loose. And apparently fuel was sprayed inside the engine compartment. There was a fire followed by a crash. Now, unfortunately, not only was the pilot killed, but the maintenance logs for this aircraft were also destroyed. But one thing that was discovered during the investigation was that the pilot had done some of the maintenance on his own. And again, the maintenance logs were destroyed, but we don't know how much maintenance was done on that particular part of the airplane. But it is clear that this fuel inlet line was the incorrect part. And here's the thing where, John, you can give some insight. It was physically looking exactly like the part that should have been there. So it was a legitimate aviation part, but a different part number. And this particular part number was not authorized to be used in that aircraft in that way. So when it comes to the ongoing issue, which has been going on for decades, of bogus parts, suspected unapproved parts, whatever verbiage you want to use there, how often do you see a situation like this, or have seen a situation like this, where the part is a legitimate aviation part, but it's simply being used in a different place in the airplane, or in a different airplane or a different engine?
It's not uncommon. Sometimes people will do that to get the airplane from here to there and then replace it with something more appropriate. But today, and when it comes to hoses such as this one, it gets into a really interesting area, because we have hydraulic hoses that oftentimes look the same as fuel line hoses, and even the fuel line hoses have to be approved for the different fuels that we have today. There was a lot of talk about the ethanol-based fuels and what they do to the seals and engines. Well, that includes hoses too. All the rubber parts have to be of a type of manufactured that can handle that ethanol-type fuel. You can't tell from looking. The hose for the hydraulic system looks the same as a hose, or can look the same as a hose for a fuel system. And the fuel system hoses, the ones that are approved for the multi-fuels, can look the same as the ones that were approved for just the avgas. So we're into a very interesting area with this accident. And although we have some people occasionally, actually people with high visibility on the internet, that talk about using automotive parts in your airplane, the one that quickly jumps into my mind is we've had some high visibility people telling GA pilots to go down to the auto store when their alternator fails and just get a regular GM alternator, and the fit will be okay. It will function, but is it really the same? We have no way of knowing. And especially if you buy, in that case, if you buy a rebuilt alternator that's not rebuilt by the manufacturer, now you really don't know what's inside that alternator. And if they're buying this alternator because they're price conscious, they're probably going to buy the cheapest one that they can find, which just exasperates the problems that I just mentioned. So it's really crazy for an owner-operator to go use unapproved parts on his airplane, especially when you only have one engine.
Now, let me speculate a little bit here about the aftermath of this. Now, unfortunately, as stated before, the pilot was killed, the aircraft was destroyed. If the estate of the pilot were to go to either the insurance company, the engine manufacturer, say, hey, you know, your engine, you know, spewed fuel all over the place, this engine caught on fire, the plane crashed, we should sue somebody. Or to the insurance company, we lost this aircraft, please compensate us. The fact that you put in something that was not an authorized part, or let me be specific, an aviation part was used incorrectly, and the fact that there's no real record of the maintenance that was done or who did it because those records were destroyed, I'd say there's a pretty good argument on the insurance company side that, hey, there's a pretty good possibility that whatever happened here, there was some either incorrect or unauthorized repairs going on. We're not going to cover this. And of course, if you're trying to sue elsewhere in civil court, that same sort of argument can be made by the other side. By the way, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to play one on the internet. But it's like, look, this is not the engine that was supposed to go with this airplane, because this very critical part, this part that was actually at the source of the fuel leak, which caused the fire, was not the right part. So you might save a few bucks in the beginning, and I'm all for that. And I'm all for economizing your experience in aviation. But this might be a step too far because of the potential consequences. And like you said, John, you've been dealing with unapproved parts or unapproved installations for years. I mean, is this kind of problem something that is, well, something you've seen more than once in your career?
I can go all the way back to the early 90s and maybe the 80s, where I've worked on committees with the FAA dealing with suspected unapproved parts. They've been popping up in the industry for a while. Why? Because airplane parts are expensive. We actually had a bolt while I worked for US Air. There's a bolt that holds it's the pivot bolt for the horizontal stabilizer, part of the trim system. One big bolt, trying to get both my fingers on the screen, one big bolt that pivots the front end up and down, holds the trim actuator in place. In the 70s, the early 70s, that bolt cost $4,000. So I don't know what it would cost today, but it was $4,000. They were being made in China. Plated, looked identical to the part that you were looking for. It was just made with inferior materials. And another example in the early 90s for a major airline, in quality inspection, the inspector, mechanic, who was the inspector, receiving inspector, didn't like the way the part felt. Now, here's the benefit of having people that do a job repeatedly. He didn't like the way the part felt. So he raised that with his supervisor. The supervisor came over and looked at it, and the supervisor said, that's all right, let it go. But he didn't. He put it aside. And then later on, when there was a little break in the action for him, He took the part and all the paperwork up to engineering. It just so happened that it was a young engineer in that area that was responsible for that. And the engineer dug into it and they did a little testing on it and found out that it was a bogus part. The material made was not hardened. It was just plated after it was machined and made to look like the original part. Sometimes you get lucky, and then obviously this young guy, the receiving inspector, did a good job for the airline in that particular case. But there's times we're really going to get through. In the 90s, we had a massive, the FAA finally uncovered enough problems with the parts. They had a massive effort on that you had to produce the records with all the parts that you put on the airplane, because there was a lot of parts that weren't done. And that was the same period of time, you know, the same decade, if you will, where NASA lost a satellite because of bogus parts. They've had bogus parts on the space shuttle, and it really got a lot of focus and a lot of attention. And I really thought that by the latter half of the 90s, that we had driven that problem out of the system. But I was proven wrong. While I was at the board before I left in 2004, unapproved parts started popping their head up again. There was a few times where it was identified by staff, but it wasn't the cause of the problem. So it wasn't the probable cause of the accident, but it was something that they found on the side. Maybe during an engine inspection, I forget all the details. But in any event, that they had some pieces that they believe were unapproved parts, but it wasn't directly responsible for the accident. So it just sort of got given to the FAA to deal with, because that's their responsibility. It hasn't gone away. Problem hasn't gone away. It's unusual that we catch this like this one. Now, it does sound like it was an owner-installed part because it was loose. Did he get distracted? Did he put it on and was going to check to see if it was the right one and didn't tighten it up enough? We'll never know. Most mechanics wouldn't leave it loose unless, I don't know where the physical location was, unless it was very difficult to get to, which then would lead you to really believe that if it was owner installed, that he may have left it loose. But in any event, somebody left it loose. And answering, and I'm not an attorney either, but I do know the insurance companies in cases like this may not pay. I've seen similar cases where they've raised the issue, and I don't know what the outcome was, but I know they raised the issues initially that there was a problem. The airplane was not airworthy, and they're not going to pay for airplanes that are not airworthy. So they have a big way to get out of that. They're paying this claim. Did they? I don't know. But it's certainly, once you install an unapproved part, that airplane's unairworthy. Even if it operates fine, it's unairworthy.
There were opportunities, though, to find this out. And in the report, it stated that a local mechanic had performed the most recent annual inspection roughly 11 months before this event, and said that the pilot often performed maintenance on his own aircraft. Now, again, because the maintenance records were destroyed, it's unclear what maintenance that pilot did after this inspection. But also, and this I found this intriguing, if you're inspecting an aircraft, you're a mechanic doing an annual inspection, and it's not practical to check every part number on every part of the airplane, because clearly some parts are not going to be visible unless you tear the aircraft apart. But more importantly, if you have a part, which like this one was physically like the correct part, but it had a different part number, is a mechanic typically required to confirm, not even typically, even atypically required to confirm that the part they are looking at, where they can see the part number, matches the correct part for that part of the airplane? I mean, your experience as a mechanic, do you do that sort of thing?
There are some components that you're required to look at because they're critical components, but routinely to look at every piece of on the airplane that you can read a part number on, no, you're not required to go tear it down like that and find the part numbers and compare them. You know, the assumption is that if a mechanic installed the part, he would have installed the correct part number. That's his responsibility. He has signed for it. Right? It gets to be a little murky when you start to get owner-installed parts in the year between annual inspections. There's a lot of work that can go on airplanes. And I've seen airplanes waiting to come into to a, an annual inspection. And I got called over to one not too long ago that showed me a wire that was strung from the back of the cabin to the tail light on the airplane. And it had was secured nowhere from the tail light where it was soldered on. It was dangling right up to the back attachment point for the interior of the airplane, where then it ran under the sidewalls, the airplane under the door to get to power. So it was secured that area, but in the back, it was totally unsecured, just dangling in the breeze back there. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen in these airplanes when they're away from its annual inspections. And then, owners and operators will complain about the people doing the annual inspection. Well, they find all this stuff. Well, if you're not taking care of your airplane every time it needs work, that guy who's signing it off is putting his certificate on the line, his livelihood on the line, his ability to work in aviation. So he's going to watch pretty closely what's going on. He's not going to want to sign anything that's obviously making the airplane unairworthy.
Now, speaking
The
of this airplane,
luck for a mechanic is that you let something go that's unairworthy, like a wire like that, and the FAA will ram check the airplane and find it. The AMP cannot let that stuff go. He's got to fix it. Or he's got to inform you of it and say, I did the annual and these items are open. And pilot, the owner can make some, depending on what's left open, he can decide not to do the work as long as it's not going to affect the airworthiness of the airplane. But my example of that wire does affect the airworthiness of the airplane because if it's disconnected, you lose your tail light.
now, in this accident, there were possibly other things going on prior to this. Now, clearly, there was a loose fuel inlet line that sprayed fuel inside the engine compartment, and no later than right after takeoff. But before the takeoff, there were some issues. There was a flight instructor who was a friend of the pilot who was speaking to him right before the accident flight. And he said the pilot told him the aircraft was having problems with the probably the engine. He thought it might have been the magnetos or the spark plugs, given that there was a loose fuel line in this aircraft. Is it possible that fuel spewing out or leaking out could lead to a rough running engine that sounds like magnetos or spark plugs? Or is it possible there was more than one thing going on with this airplane when it took off?
Well, one of the things that came into my mind when you sent me this is the rubber hose and the fuels. Was this hose not approved to use some of the latest fuels? Well, there's a problem with the latest ethanols and the effects on engines. I mean, we've been talking about it for 10 years. If the hose was a type of rubber that ethanol could have an effect on, the effect that we know that they talk out there is the expansion of the rubber. So now you've got this hose, and let's just say it's a half an inch interior dimension. And now all of a sudden the rubber is reacting to the fuel and it swells. It's going to create a resistance to the fuel flow, which definitely could affect high power settings. And that could lead to the possibility of, in troubleshooting, this owner loosened up the fuel line at the fuel pump to see if he had fuel coming out and didn't get it tight on the way back for whatever reason. So there's a lot of different scenarios that can fit inside this set of circumstances that we have. And because a lot of the records are burned up with the airplane, we'll never know. But there's a lot of different arguments that can be made around almost every direction you come at this issue, other than the fact that we know that there was a fuel leak.
Now, the pilot was, again, stated his concern to his friend, the mechanic. The pilot stated he was going to taxi to the end of the runway, perform an engine run-up. If the engine run-up was successful, he was going to take a short flight to a nearby airport and then return. This is not the kind of airplane I fly. This was a Piper Cherokee. I fly a Cessna 172. But I know when I do my engine run-up, the run-up RPM is going to be lower than the takeoff RPM. Let's assume speculate, the run-up was successful and the pilot was not concerned enough to cancel the flight. Applies takeoff power. Things happen. Sometime during the takeoff or right after takeoff, it's unclear from the investigation. There was a fuel leak and a fuel fire was happening on the right side of the engine compartment. And he lost all power. The pilot lost all power. This was a very sudden onset, catastrophic failure of total loss of power. The aircraft crashed about 1,000 feet beyond the departure end of the runway, and this was a wooded area. So you have a situation where the pilot very likely was aware that there was A, no engine power, B, a fire happening, C, fairly low because he'd just taken off, didn't have enough altitude to turn around and come back. He had to land where he could. And it's unclear whether or not he landed in a controlled or uncontrolled manner, but the fact is this was a fatal crash. But I was thinking, looking at that line, if I thought I had a problem with the engine and was running rough, I wouldn't take it to the a run-up and then see if it's okay. I would say, you know what? It's running rough. I'm shutting down and flying another day. But again, this is an owner-operator. This is someone who is very intimately familiar with that aircraft and very likely had faith in the pilot's ability to diagnose the problem. So again, this is a decision-making under uncertainty situation where some people like myself would see the risk in this and not take off. He didn't think it was risky enough. Obviously, the aftermath shows that it was riskier than he thought. But my question is, for the average pilot in the situation, especially one who's knowledgeable about working the engine, is it reasonable to conclude this was a too risky situation to take off? I can't answer that question.
No, I can't either. But you know what? We have a long history of crashes that should not have occurred because pilots have trusted their own ability on mechanical areas. And I see it even in airliners, right? All the way up the line, pilots tend to overthink the problems and over assess their own qualities to make a troubleshooting decision. And that's why, it goes all the way up to Alaska. Alaska Airlines off the coast of California with the jack screw. They overflew 10 airports before they crashed while they were playing with a flight control in flight, which is absolutely crazy. The minute they had a problem with that flight control, they recognized they should have gone for the first available airport. And even though when they flew over San Diego, which is a tough airport, but Miramar is right next door and it's got a nice long runway. Right? And you can come up to LA with a nice 12,000 feet in LA coming in right over the water. Yes, you're going to, with a jammed stabilizer, you're going to have to land fast. But that's why you have a nice long runway.
You also have Long Beach, which has a very decent runway as well between San Diego and LA.
Right. So they were troubleshooting the whole way with encouragement from the company. The encouragement is they wanted the airplane to go where it was supposed to go. And I criticized them for that in public, and they were not happy with me for that. But, you know, that's tough luck. You have a problem with your airplane, you take care of it on the ground, not in the air. You know, and you let all these other, you know, flying through weather, very similar. If it gets bad, you got to get out of it. Get on the ground, deal with it later. This, I got to get it in, got to get it in. I got to go. I hear it over and over and over times. And we hear it on, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had this discussion with airline pilots while I was working. I was just essentially the supervisor, first line supervisor on the line. And air crews wanted to go. And I could tell them, no, you're not going anywhere. Sometimes it was a little bit of a elevated discussion about that. You do a good job of flying. I'll take care of the maintenance side of it. You're going to rely on my judgment to get you from here to there safely. In the GA field, with so much work being done by owner-operators, they get to feel like, oh, yeah, I can do anything. Yeah, maybe a lot of the jobs they can do, but the troubleshooting part should be left to somebody else. I think we covered that. So the message for our pilots out there is if you have a mechanical problem, fix it on the ground. Don't go playing around in flight. If you think you have a problem, get it looked at by somebody who knows, in this case, who knows the engine, right? Because he most likely would have figured it out, right? And maybe taking it out to the runway, we don't know what power he put it. Did he take it out and do takeoff power? Sounds to me like he didn't, right? He probably took it out and did a mag check and everything looked out good and carried on from there. I would definitely believe that that's what happened, because right after that, he didn't come in and shut the engine down. Right after that, he took off. So if it was working okay and then not, I think he didn't do a full takeoff power, because it may have shown up then. In his pre-flight of the airplane, did he not see all of a sudden the side of the cowling was clean? You know, you have this fuel leaking off, so it's going to eat up all the dirt and all the oil and the residue. It's going to streak back. It's colored. You know, it should be colored going back so you can see the stain on the fuselage. I mean, there's a lot of cues that seem like they were missed. Because if this line, if it was solely because the line was loose, it should have been a hell of a lot of fuel dumping out of that airplane.
Now, this discussion of unapproved parts and bogus parts and alternative parts brings up my second to last word. Yes, flying is expensive. Airplane parts are expensive. Maintenance is expensive. If you're in the aviation world, you know that going in. And if you're not willing to pay the cost to do it right, you're putting yourself in a position where you're giving yourself risk you don't need. It's one thing to have a completely bogus part, like a part that is from another aircraft or another part of an aircraft that you know is bogus going in. It's another thing to say, you know what, we can get away with this because it's the same size, same color, same shape, same weight, different number, but hey, it can fit on this airplane, let's go. And let me not even get into taking parts from a completely different form of transportation, be it automobiles or something else, and putting it on an airplane, on a critical part of the airplane, and thinking you can get away with it.
You know, this raises and comes right into the area of our new sponsor, right, which is piston power, where you pay by the hour for the flights that you take. This is the kind of mechanical failure that they would pay for. So really, at the time that it happened, it wouldn't cost you any more than what you're already paying every month to fly the airplane. There's another reason why having a program like that has some value. Now, we're going to have them on and talk about examples of things that they've paid for. On the last issue, I mentioned the one which is quite impressive, when they had a failure in the air conditioning system that caused a fire in the airplane and burned up a lot of pieces, and actually had burned up a part of the fuselage. At the time we were talking to them, but I think it was sometimes our sequence doesn't go in sequence for these shows. But in any event, the discussion we had with them on the show that we haven't published yet, they have actually bought an entire brand new fuselage for that airplane. And at that time, they told us it was sitting in Canada waiting to be brought into the United States to be fitted on the fuselage. It was actually less expensive to buy a fuselage than it was to repair the damage on the one that they had. So, and that is going to cost the person that owns that airplane nothing more than what they pay every month in the fee. It's not insurance. It's a maintenance program. They're very careful to say that, because it's insurance has restrictions. And so it's not an insurance policy. It's a program, a maintenance program, where its power essentially mirrors what the airlines do with power by the hour. Most of our airlines have a maintenance program on their engines. GE is a big one. On the CFM56 engine that's on the 737, on thousands of them, most of those engines go back to the manufacturer or manufacturer's shop. Well, I know of one in Oklahoma where they get a lot of engines that come off, and they do the overhaul, because the airlines are paying X number of dollars per hour of flight for the use of those engines. And the overhaul is done by somebody else. And that means that the manufacturer then, when they open the engine up and finds out that they got big problems inside, the airlines don't have to pay that cost. It smooths out the cost of just doing business, which is the benefit for it. So even for people who own an airplane themselves, to know that I'm going to pay, I'm just going to pick a number out of the air, $50 an hour to fly my airplane, but all my problems are taken care of. My annual inspection, everything is paid for. That makes it a lot easier. You don't bring your airplane in for an annual and suddenly find out you got a $10,000 or $12,000 bill that you got to pay before you get your airplane out. Well, we're going to go through that in more detail pretty soon. But in any event, we've disrupted our closing sequence. So do you have anything you want to add, Todd?
Just that it's time for you to give us the last word.
All right. And as usual, the last word, and it fits right in with this one. First off, you do a good job of pre-planning. Sounds like this guy already knew before he came out to the airport that he had an engine issue. So here's a red flag right there. Then when you get out to the airplane, you need to perform a good pre-flight. And as I mentioned earlier, all right, if he's got that kind of a fuel leak, the belly of that airplane's got to be clean and stained. Right? This may even be dripping on the ramp. You got to keep your eyes open, pay attention. After you get off the ground, please put the head on a swivel, because we still see near misses on a regular basis, and we still have collisions occasionally, and you don't want to get into an accident, especially if it's somebody else's accident. So please, please pay attention and fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.